pain. The pain of being obsolete. I go down to Santa Monica sometimes and walk along through the Oceanside Park that forms the outermost edge of California. There, at the shore of the Pacific, like flotsam washed up by America with no place to go, are the old people. Their time has come. Their eyes look out across the water for another beginning, but they have come to the final moments. They sit in the vanilla sunshine, and they dream of yesterday. Kind old people, for the most part. They talk to each other. They talk to themselves. And they wonder where it all went. I stop and sit on the benches and talk to them sometimes. Not often. It makes me think of endings rather than continuations or new beginnings. They're sad, but they have a nobility that cannot be ignored. They're passed over, obsolescent, but they still run well, and they have good minutes in them. Their pain is a terrible thing because it cries to be given the chance to work those arthritic fingers at something meaningful, to work those brain cells at something challenging. This story is about someone in the process of being passed over, being made obsolete. He fights. I would fight. Some of the old people in Santa Monica fight. Do we ever win? Against the shadow that inevitably falls, no. Against the time between now and the shadow's arrival? Yes, certainly. That's the message in Wanted in Surgery. Chapter 1. A man named Tibor Karaly Zibak, who had escaped from the People's Hungarian Protectorate to the North American Continent Sanctuary late in the year 2087, invented it. While working as a bonded technician for the Orin Tool and Tree Conglomerate on a design to create a robot capable of fine watch repairs, he discovered the factor of multiple choice. He was able to apply this concept to the cellulose-plasteel brain of his watch repair robot's pilot model and came up with the startling physician mechanical. Infinitely more intricate than a mere robot mechanical, yet far simpler than a human brain, it was capable, after proper conditioning, of the most delicate of operations. Furthermore, the FIMEC, as it was tagged soon after, was capable of infallible diagnosis involving anything organic. The mind was still locked to the powers of the metal physician, but for the ills of the body, there was no more capable administrator. Zibak died several weeks after his pilot model had been demonstrated at a special closed session of the House of Congress from a coronary thrombosis. But his death was more of a propelling factor to widespread recognition of the FIMEC than his life could ever have been. The House of Congress appointed a committee of fact-finders from the firm of Data Unlimited, who had successfully completed the Orinoco Basin probe and compared their three-month findings with the current histophysiology appropriations allocated to the Secretary of Medicine. They found FIMECs could be operated in all the socialized hospitals of the continent for far less than was being spent on doctors' salaries. After all, a doctor continued to need. A FIMEC absorbed 1/2 pint of liquefied radiol every 3 years and an occasional lubrication to ensure proper functioning. So the government passed a law, the Hippocratic Law of 2088, which said, in essence, all ministrations shall henceforth be confined to government-sponsored hospitals. Emergency cases necessitating attendance outside said institutions shall be handled only, repeat, only by registered physician mechanicals issuing from registered hospital pools. Any irregularities or deviations from this procedure shall be handled as cases outside the law, and illegal attendance by non-mechanical physicians shall be severely punishable by cancellation of practicing license and or fine and imprisonment. Johns Hopkins was the first to be defranchised, then the Columbia School of Medicine, and the other colleges followed shortly thereafter. A few specialist schools were maintained for a time, but it became increasingly apparent after the first 3 years of FIMAC operation that even the specialists were slow compared to the robot doctors. So even they passed away. Doctors who had been licensed before the innovations the FIMECs brought were maintained at slashed salaries and were reduced to assistants, interns. They were, however, given a few annuities, which boiled down eventually to, one, a franking privilege, so postage was unnecessary on their letters, two, a small annual dole, three, subscriptions to current medical journals, now filled with more electronic data persistent to FIMEX than surgical techniques, and four, honorary titles. Doctors in title only. There was dissatisfaction. In 2091, Kolbenschlag, the greatest brain surgeon of them all, died. He passed away on a quiet October morning, with the climate dome purring ever so faintly above the city and the distant scream of the transport sphincter opening to allow the Earth-Mars 8 o'clock liner through. A quiet, drawn-faced man with a great talent in slim fingers. He died in his sleep, and the papers clacked out of the home slots with heavy black headlines across yellow plastic sheets, but not about Kolbenschlag. He was yesterday's news. The headline was about the total automation changeover in the Ford Chrysler plants. On page 118, there was a five-line obituary that labeled him, quote, a pre-FIMEC surgeon of some skill, unquote. It also reported, he had died of acute alcoholism. It was not specifically true. His death was caused by a composite, acute alcoholism, and a broken heart. He died alone, but he was remembered by the men and women who, like Kolbenschlag, had spent their early lives in dedication to the staff and the lion's head, the hand and eagle's eye, by men and women who could not adjust. The small legion of men and women who still walked the antiseptic corridors of the hospitals. Men like Stuart Bergman, M.D. This is his story. Chapter 2. The main operation theater of Memorial was constructed along standard lines. The observation bubble was set high on one wall, curving large and down, with a separating section allowing two viewing stands. The operating stage, on a telescoping base that raised or lowered it for easier observation from the bubble, squatted in the center of the room. There were no operating lamps in the ceiling, as in old-style hospitals, for the FIMECs had their powerful Eterna light mounted atop their heads, serving their needs more accurately than any outside light source could have. Beyond the stage, there were anesthetic spheres clipped to the walls in five container groups, where they could be easily reached should the FIMEX personal supply run dry, and a rapid-roll belt running from a digital supply machine beside the operating table to the see-through selector cabinets that stood by the exits. That was all. Everything that was needed. Even the spheres and extra cabinets might have been dispensed with, but somehow they had been maintained, just slightly limiting the FIMEX abilities, as though to reassure some unnamed person that they needed help, even if it was mechanical help, to help the mechanicals. The three FIMECs were performing the operation directly beneath the bubble when Bergman came in. The bubble was dark, but he could see Murray Thomas's craggy features set against the light of the operating stage. The illumination had been a concession to the human observers, for with their own Eterna lights, the FIMECs could work in a total blackout during a power failure. Bergman held the crumpled news sheet in his hand, page 118 showing, and stared at the scene below him. Naturally, it would be a brain operation today. The one day it should be a mere goiter job or a plantar stripping, if just to keep him steady. But no, it had to be a brain job with the FIMEX 30 telescoping snake-like appendages extruded and snicking into the patient. Bergman swallowed hard, and made his way down the slope of aisle to the empty seat beside Thomas. He was a dark man, with an almost unnaturally spade-like face. High, prominent cheekbones giving him a gaunt look, and veins that stood out along the temples. His nose was thin and humped where it had been broken years before. His eyes were deep and darkest blue, so they appeared black. His hair was thin, roughly combed, back from the forehead without affectation or wave, just combed because he had to keep the hair from his eyes. He slumped into the seat, keeping his eyes off the operation below, keeping the face of Murray Thomas in his sight, with the light from below playing up across the round, unflustered features. He held out the news sheet, touching Thomas's arm with it. For the first time, as the young doctor started, Thomas realized Bergman was there. He turned slowly, and his placid stare met the wild look of Bergman. A question began to form, but Thomas cast a glance behind him, toward the top of the seat tier, at the silent, dark bulk of the head resident. He put a hand on Bergman's arm, and then he saw the news sheet. Bergman offered it another inch, and Thomas took it. He opened it out, turning it below the level of the seats, trying to catch the light from below. He roamed the page for a moment, then his hands crumpled tight on the plastic. He saw the five-line filler. Kolbenschlag was dead. He turned to Bergman, and his eyes held infinite sorrow. He mouthed with his lips the words, "I'm sorry, Stuart," but they died midway between them. He stared at Bergman's face for a moment, knowing he could do nothing for the man now. Kolbenschlag had been Stuart Bergman's teacher, his friend, more a father to him than the father Bergman had run away from in his youth. Now Bergman was totally alone, for his wife Thelma was no help in this situation. Her constitution could not cope with a case of inner disintegration. With difficulty, he turned back to the operation, feeling an overwhelming desire to take Bergman's hand, to help ease away the sorrow he knew coursed through the man. But the sorrow was a personal thing, and he was cut off from the tense man beside him. Bergman watched the operation now. There was nothing else to do. He had spent 10 years of his life training to be a physician, and now he was sitting watching faceless blocks of metal do those 10 years better than he ever could. Murray Thomas was abruptly aware of heavy breathing beside him. He didn't turn his head. He had seen Bergman getting nearer and nearer the cracking point for weeks now, ever since the FIMEX had been completely installed and the human doctors had been relegated to assistants, interns, instrument carriers. He feverishly hoped this was not the moment Bergman would choose to fall apart. The FIMEX below were proceeding with the delicate operation. One of the telescoping snake-like tentacles of one FIMEX had a wafer-thin circular saw on it, and as Thomas watched, the saw sliced down, and they could hear the buzz of steel meeting skull. "God in heaven, stop it, stop it, stop it!" Thomas was an instant too late. Bergman was up out of his seat, down the aisle, and banging his fists against the clear plasteel of the observation bubble before he could be stopped. It produced a feeling of utter hysteria in the bubble, as though all of them wanted to scream, had been holding it back, and now were struggling with the sounds not to join in. Bergman battered himself up against the clearness of the bubble, mumbling, screaming, his face a riot of pain and horror. "Not even a decent death," he was screaming. "He lies down there, and rotten, dirty metal things, goddammit, things rip up his patients. Oh, God. Where is the way? Where? Then the three interns erupted from the door at the top rear of the bubble and ran down the aisle. In an instant, they had Bergman by the shoulders, the arms, the neck, and were dragging him back up the aisle. Collins, the head resident, yelled after them, "Take him to my office for observation. I'll be right there." Murray Thomas watched his friend disappear in the darkness toward the rectangle of light in the rear wall. Then he was gone. And Thomas heard Collins say, "Ignore that outburst, doctors. There is always someone who gets squeamish at the sight of a well-performed operation. Then he was gone, off to examine Bergman. And Murray Thomas felt a brassy, bitter taste on his tongue. Bergman, afraid of blood, the sight of an operation? Not likely. He had seen Stuart Bergman work many times, not Stuart Bergman. The operating room was home to Bergman. No, it hadn't been that. Then it was that Thomas realized. The incident had completely shattered the mood and attention of the men in the bubble. They were incapable of watching the FIMAX any further today. But the FIMAX, they were undisturbed, unseeing, uncaring, calmly, coolly working, taking off the top of the patient's skull. Thomas felt desperately ill. Chapter 3.
Honest to God, I tell you, Murray, I can't take it much longer.
Bergman was still shaking from the examination in Collins' offices. His hands were prominent with blue veins, and they trembled ever so slightly across the form atop of the table. The dim sounds of the medical center filtered to them in the hush booth. Bergman ran a hand through his hair.
Every time I see one of those...
He paused, hesitated, then did not use the word. Murray Thomas knew the word. Had it come forth, would have been monster. Bergman went on, a blank space in his sentence.
Every time I see one of them picking around inside one of my patients with those metal tips, I get sick to my stomach. It's all I can do to keep from ripping out its goddamned wiring.
His face was deathly pale, yet somehow unnaturally flushed. He quivered as he spoke, and quivered again. Dr. Murray Thomas put out a hand placatingly.
Now take it easy, Stu. You keep getting yourself all hot over this thing, and if it doesn't break you, which it damned well easily could, they'll revoke your license, bar you from practicing.
He looked across at Bergman and blinked assuringly, as if to keynote his warning. Bergman muttered with surliness,
Fine lot of practicing I do now, or you for that matter.
Thomas tapped a finger on the table. It caused the multicolored bits of plastic beneath the formatop to jiggle, casting pinpoints of light across Bergman's strained features.
And besides, Stu, you have no logical, scientific reason for hating the FIMAX.
Bergman stared back angrily.
Science doesn't come into it, and you know it. This is from the gut, Murray, not the brain. Look, Stu, they're infallible. They're safer, and they can do a job quicker with less mess than even a Kolbenschlag. Right?
Bergman nodded reluctantly, but there was a dangerous edge to his expression.
But at least Kolbenschlag, even with those thick-lensed glasses, was human. It wasn't like having a piece of stovepipe rummaging around in a patient's stomach.
He shook his head sadly in remembrance.
Old Fritz couldn't take it. That's what killed him. Those damned machines. Playing intern to a FIMAC was too much for him. Oh, hell. You know what a grand heart that old man had, Murray. 50 years in medicine, and then to be barely allowed to hold the sponge for a lousy TikTok, and what was worse, knowing that TikTok could hold the sponge more firmly with one of its pincers. That's what killed old Fritz.
Bergman added softly, staring at his shaking hands.
And at that, he's the lucky one. And then, we're the damned of our culture, Murray. The kept men of medicine.
Thomas looked up startled, then annoyed.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Stuart. Stop being melodramatic. Nothing of the sort. If a better scalpel comes along, do you refuse to discard the old issue because you've used it so long? Don't be an ass. But we're not scalpels. We're men. We're doctors.
He was on his feet suddenly, as though the conversation had been physically building in him, forcing an explosion. The two whiskey glasses slipped and dumped as his thighs banged the table in rising. Bergman's voice was raised and his temples throbbed, yet he was not screaming.
Even so, the words came out louder than any scream. "For God's sake, Stu, sit down!" Thomas looked apprehensively around the medical center lounge. "If the head resident should walk in, we'd both get our throats cut. Sit down, will you already?" Bergman slumped slowly back onto the form seat. It depressed and flowed around him, caressingly, and he squirmed in agony as though it were strangling him. Even after he was fully seated, his shoulders continued rounding. His eyes were wild. Beads of perspiration stood out on his forehead, his upper lip. Thomas leaned forward, a frown creasing his mouth. "Take hold, Stu. Don't let a thing like this ruin you. Better men than us have felt this way about it, but you can't stop progress. And losing your head, doing something crazy like that exhibition at the operation yesterday, won't do any of us any good. It's all we can do to maintain what rights we have left. It's a bad break for us, Stu, but it's good for the whole rest of the human race. And damn it, man, they come before us. It's as simple as that." He drew a handkerchief from his breast pouch and mopped at the spreading twin pools of liquor, covertly watching Bergman from behind lowered lashes. The sudden blare of a juke brought Bergman's head up, his nostrils flaring. When he realized what it was, he subsided, the lights vanishing from his eyes. He rested his head in his hand, rubbing slowly up and down the length of his nose. "How did it all start, Murray? I mean, all this..." He looked at the roaring juke that nearly drowned out conversation despite the hush booth, the bar with its mechanical drink interpolator. Remarkable mnemonic circuits, capable of mixing 10,000 different liquors flawlessly, and intoxication estimator. The fully mechanized hospital, rearing huge outside the plasteel-fronted bar. Robot physicians glimpsed occasionally passing before a lighted window. Windows showing light only because the human patients and fallible doctors needed it. The robots needed no light. They needed no fame and no desire to help mankind. All they needed was their power pack and an occasional oiling, in return for which they saved mankind. Bergman's mind tossed the bitter irony about like a dog with a foul rag in its mouth. Murray Thomas sighed softly, considered Bergman's question. He shook his head.
"I don't know, Stu."
The words paced themselves, emerging slowly, reluctantly.
"Perhaps it was the automatic pilot, or the tactical computers they used in the Third War, or maybe even farther back than that. Maybe it was as far back as electric sewing machines, and hydromatic shift cars, and self-serve elevators. It was machines, and they worked better than humans. That was it, pure and simple. A hunk of metal is 9 times out of 10 better than a fallible human."
Thomas considered what he had said, added definitely,
"I'll take that back. 10 times out of 10. There's nothing a cybernetics man can't build into one of those things now. It was inevitable they'd get around to taking human lives out of the hands of mere men."
He looked embarrassed for an instant at the length and tone of his reply, then sighed again and downed the last traces of his drink, running his tongue absently around the lip of the glass, tasting the dried liquid there. Bergman's intensity seemed to pulse, grow stronger. He was obviously trying to find an answer to the problem of himself, within himself. He hunched further over, looking into his friend's face earnestly, almost boyishly.
But it doesn't seem right, somehow. We've always depended on doctors, human doctors, to care for the sick and dying. It was a constant, Murray, a something you could depend on. In time of war, a doctor was inviolate. In times of need, I know it sounds maudlin, Murray. For God's sake, in times of need, a doctor was a priest and father and teacher and patriot and...
He made futile motions with his hands, as though pleading the words to appear from the air. Then he continued in a stronger voice,
from a memory ground into his mind.
I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art. And whatsoever houses I enter, I will enter to help the sick, and I will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm, and whatsoever I shall see or hear in the course of my profession and my intercourse with men, if it be what should not be published abroad, I will never divulge, holding such things to be holy secrets.
Thomas's eyebrows rose slightly as his lips quirked in an unconscious smile. He had known Bergman would resort to the oath eventually. Dedicated wasn't enough of a word to describe Stuart Bergman, it seemed. He was right. It was maudlin. And still, Bergman continued,
what good is it all now? They've only had the Fimex a few years now, only a few, and they have them in solidly, even though there are things about them they aren't sure about. So what good were all the years in school and study and tradition? We can't even go into the homes anymore.
His face seemed to grow more haggard under the indirect gleam of the glazed lights in the lounge. His hair seemed grayer than a moment before. The lines of his face were deeper. He swallowed nervously, ran a finger through the faint coating of wet left by the spilled drinks.
What kind of a practice is that? To carry slop buckets? To be allowed to watch as the robots cut and sew our patients? To be kept behind glass at the big operations? To see the red lights flash on the hot board and know a mobilized monster is rolling faster than an ambulance to the scene? Is that what you're telling me I have to adjust to? Are you, Murray? Don't expect me to be as calm about it as you. And most degrading of all, he added, as if to solidify his arguments, to have them throw us a miserable appendectomy or stomach pump job once a week like scraps from the table. And watch us while we do it. What are we, dogs? To be treated like pets? I tell you, I'm going crazy, Murray. I go home at night and find myself even cutting my steak as though it were heart tissue. Anything, anything at all just to remind myself that I was trained for surgery. My God. And I think of all the years, all the sweat, all the gutting and starving just to come to this. Murray, where's it gonna end?
He was on the verge of another scene like the one in the operating room observation bubble. Whatever had happened when the head resident had examined Bergman, and it seemed to have been cleared up, for Bergman was still scheduled on the boards as Fimec assistant, though his weekly operation had been set ahead 3 days, it wouldn't do to let it flare up again. And Murray Thomas knew things were boiling inside his ex-schoolmate. He had no idea how long it would be before the lid blew off, ruining Bergman permanently.
Calm down, Stuart, he said. Let me dial you another drink. Don't touch that goddamn mechanical thing,
he roared, striking Thomas's hand from the interpolator dial. He gasped raggedly.
There are some things a machine can't do. Machines brush my teeth in the morning, and they cook my food, and they lull me to sleep, but there must be something they can't do better than a human. Otherwise, why did God create humans? To be waited on by tin cans? I don't know what they are, but I swear there must be some abilities a human possesses that a robot doesn't. There must be something that makes a man more valuable than a whirring, clanking chunk of tin.
He stopped, out of breath. It was then that Collins, the head resident, stepped around the panel separating the booths from the bar. The head resident stood there silently, watching for a moment, like a hound on point. He fingered the lapel on his sport jumper absently.
Getting a bit noisy, aren't you, Dr. Bergman?
Stuart Bergman's face was alive with fear. His eyes lowered to his hands, entwined like serpents seeking sanctuary in each other, white with the pressure of his clasping. His fingers writhed.
I was just airing a few views, that's all, Dr. Collins. Rather nasty views, I must say, Dr. Bergman. Might be construed as dissatisfaction with the way I'm handling things at Memorial. You wouldn't want anyone to think that, would you, Dr. Bergman? His words had taken on the tone of command, of steel embedded in rock. Bergman shook his head quickly, slightly, nervously. No, I didn't mean that at all, Dr. Collins. I was just, well, you know, I thought perhaps if we physicians had a few more operations, a few more difficult... Don't you think the Fimex are quite capable of handling any such, Dr. Bergman? There was an air of expectancy in his voice, waiting for Bergman to say the wrong thing. That's what you'd like, wouldn't you, Collins? That's what you want. His thoughts spun sidewise, madly. I suppose so. Yes, I know they are. It was, well, it's difficult to remember I'm a doctor, not doing any work for so long and all, and that's about enough, Bergman, snapped Collins. The government subsidized the Fimex, and they used taxpayers' money to keep them serviced and saving lives. They have a finer record than any human, Bergman broke in sharply, but they haven't been fully tested, or... Collins stared him into silence, replied, If you want to remain on the payroll, remain in the hospital, Dr. Bergman, even as an assistant, you'd better tone down and watch yourself, Bergman. We have our eyes on you. But I said that's enough, Bergman. Turning to Murray Thomas, he added violently, And I'd watch who I keep company with, Thomas, if I were you. That's all. Good evening. He strode off, lightly, almost jauntily, arrogance in each step, leaving Bergman huddled in a corner of the booth, staring wild-eyed at his hands. Rotten, lousy appointee, snarled Thomas softly. If it weren't for his connections with the Secretary of Medicine, he'd be in the same boat with us. The lousy bastard. I guess I'd better be getting home. Mumbled Bergman, sliding out of the booth. A sudden blast from the juke shivered him, and he regained his focus on Thomas with difficulty. Thelma's probably waiting dinner for me. Thanks for having a drink with me, Murray. I'll see you at wash-up tomorrow. He ran a finger down the front of his jumper, sealing the suit. He pulled up his collar, sealing the suit to the neck. A fine spray of rain... scheduled for this time by WeatherX, was dotting the huge, transparent front of the lounge, and Bergman stared at it, engrossed for an instant, as though seeing something deeper in the rain. He drew a handful of octagonal plastic chits from his pouch, dropped them into the pay slot on his side of the table, and started away. The machine registered an overpayment, but he did not bother to collect the surplus coins. He paused, turned for a moment, then, Thanks, Murray. And he was gone into the rain. Poor slob, thought Dr. Murray Thomas, an ache beginning to build within him for things he could not name. Just can't adjust. He knew he couldn't hold it, but he dialed another drink. He regretted it while doing it, but that ache had to be avoided at all costs. The drink was a double. Chapter 4 That night was hell. Hell with the torture of memories past and present. He knew he had been acting like a fool, that he was just another stupid man who could not accept what was to be. But there was more. And it pervaded his thoughts, his dreams. He had been a coward in front of Collins. He felt strongly, God, more than merely strongly. Yet he has backed down. After making an ass of himself at the operation, the day of old Fritz Kolbenschlag's death, he had backed down. He had run away from his problem. Now all the years that he had lived by the oath were wasted. His life seemed to be a failure. He had struggled desperately to get where he was, and now that he was there, he was nowhere. He had run away. It was the first time since he had been very young that he had felt that way.
He lay on the bed, the form-cling sheet rumpled half on the floor at the foot of the bed. Thelma lay silent in the other hush bunk, the blanker, keeping her snores from disturbing him. And the memories slid by slowly. He could still remember the time a friend had fallen into a cistern near a deserted house before the dome, and fear had prevented his descending to save his playmate. The boy had drowned, and 10-year-old Stuart Bergman had fostered a guilt of that failure he had carried ever since. It had, he sometimes thought, been one of the factors that had contributed to his decision to become a doctor. Now again, years later, he was helpless and trembling in the spider's mesh of a situation in which he could not move to do what he knew was right. He didn't know why he was so set against them. Murray's analogy of the scalpel was perfectly valid. But something sensed but unnamed in his guts told him he was right. This was unnatural, damnable, that humans were worked over by machines. It somehow, irrationally, seemed a plan of the devil. He had heard people call the machines the devil's playthings. Perhaps they were right. He lay on his bed, sweating, feeling incomplete, feeling filthy, feeling contaminated by his own inadequacy and his cowardice before Collins. He screwed his face up in agony, in self-castigation, shutting his eyes tight till the nerves running through his temples throbbed. Then he placed the blame where it really belonged. Why was he suffering? Why was his once full life so suddenly empty and framed by worthlessness? Fear. Fear of what? Why was he afraid? Because the Fimex had taken over. Again, the same answer, and in his mind, his purpose resolved, solidified. He had to get the Fimex discredited, had to find some reason for them to be thrown out. But how? How? They were better, in all ways, weren't they? 3 days later, as he assisted a Fimec on his scheduled operating assignment, the answer came to Bergman as horribly as he might have wished. It came in the form of a practical demonstration, and he was never to forget it. The patient had been involved in a thresher accident on one of the group farms. The suckermouth thresher had whipped him off his feet and dragged him in feet first. He had saved himself from being completely chewed to bits by placing his hands around the mouth of the thresher, and others had rushed in to drag him free before his grip loosened. He had fainted from pain and luckily, for the sucker mouth, had ground off both his legs just below the knees. When they wheeled him before Bergman with his oxygen mask and tube in hand, and the Fimec with instruments already clasped in 9 of its 13 magnetic tips, the man was covered with a sheet. Bergman's transparent face mask quivered as he drew back the sheet exposing the man. They had bound up the stumps and cauter halted the bleeding, but the patient was as badly off as Bergman had ever seen an injured man. "It'll be close all the way. Thank God in this case the Fimec is fast and efficient. No human could save this one in time." So intent was he on watching the Fimec's technique, so engrossed was he at the snicker and gleam of the instruments being whipped from their cubicles in the Fimec storage bin chest, he failed to adjust the anesthesia cone properly. Bergman watched the intricate play of the Fimec tentacles as they telescoped out and back from the small holes in each shoulder globe. He watched the tortured flesh being stripped back to allow free play for the sutures. The faint hiss of the imperfectly fitted cone reached him too late. The patient sat up, suddenly, straight up, with hands rigid to the table. His eyes opened, and he stared down at the ripped and bloodied stumps where his legs had been. His screams echoed back from the operating room walls. "Oh, I want to die! I want to die! I want to die!" Over and over, his hysterical screams beat at Bergman's consciousness. The Fimec automatically moved to leech off the rising panic in the patient, but it was too late. The patient fainted, and almost instantly, the cardio showed a dip. The spark was going out. The FIMEC ignored it. There was nothing it could do about it. Organically, the man was being handled efficiently. The trouble was emotional, where the FIMEC never went. Bergman stared in horror. The man was dying, right out from under the tentacles. Why doesn't the thing try to help the man? Why doesn't he soothe him? Let him know it'll be all right. He's dying because he's in shock. He doesn't want to live. Just a word would do. Bergman's thoughts whipped themselves into a frenzy, but the FIMEC continued operating, calmly, hurriedly, but with the patient failing rapidly. Bergman started forward, intent to reach the patient. The injured man had looked up and seen himself amputated bloodily just beneath the knees, and worse, had seen the faceless metal entity working over him. At that crucial moment, when any little thing could sway the desire to live, the man had seen no human with whom he could identify, merely a rounded and planed block of metal. He wanted to die. Bergman reached out to touch the patient. Without ceasing its activities, the FIMEC extruded a chamois-mitt tentacle and removed Bergman's hand. The hollow, inflectionless voice of the robot darted from its throat speaker. No interference, please. This is against the rules. Bergman drew back, horror stamped across his fine features, his skin literally crawling from the touch of the robot and from the sight of the FIMEC operating steadily on a corpse. The man had lost the spark. The operation was a success, as they had often quipped, but the patient was dead. Bergman felt nausea grip him with sodden fingers, and he doubled over, turning quickly toward the wall. He stared up at the empty observation bubble. Thankful, this was a standard routine operation, and no viewers sat behind the clearness up there. He leaned against the feeder trough of the instrument cabinets and vomited across the sparkling gray plasteel tiles. A servo mech skittered free of its cubicle and cleaned away the mess immediately. It only heightened his sickness. Machines cleaning up for machines. He didn't bother finishing as assistant on the FIMEC's grisly operation. It would do no good, and besides, the FIMEC didn't need any help. It wasn't human.